Stormy, please let me know if you're good to go. Stormy, with Ben.
Yes, we just keeping track of the trickling in. We are four at the moment.
Okay. Don't let me know.
Okay, will do.
All right, thanks, BK.
Okay.
Good morning, colleagues.
Recording in progress.
And welcome to our meeting this morning on a briefing by National Treasury on state-owned company bailouts and government guarantees. Colleagues, you will recall that we had initially not had a meeting scheduled for today, but it did dawn on us that the Minister of Finance in the budget speech made quite a number of sweeping pronouncements insofar as bailouts and government guarantees were concerned in a number of SOEs, some of which we are dealing with, some of which following on the AG presentation that we had on the SOEs. So to bring the picture full circle, because let's make use, constructive use of this meeting day available to us. And I therefore want to thank you and apologize for the short notice that we convened this meeting. And so that will explain, colleagues, why maybe National Treasury's report or presentation arrived late. It was simply because of that reason towards the end of last week. And I want to thank National Treasury for moving with speed and haste to ensure that we are briefed when we requested that we do. Just one, recognizing the minimal time that we have and the extent of work that we have. Any meeting, they shouldn't be lost really unless it's absolutely necessary. So colleagues, that's the background, hence the virtual meeting as well. So what we'll do is we're gonna go to National Treasury colleagues, and they will be very patient with us because we've only just, received. So they'll humbagahle on this one. I know we usually want a summary, so they will go to all the details of it as is contained in the presentation, and then we'll take questions after. So colleagues, that's the background to this meeting. So thank you very much for being here, and then of course tomorrow we're meeting physically on those matters that we discussed last week around Eskom, and then tomorrow evening we're meeting Public Works and Infrastructure. All right, colleagues, I hope you are all fine. Can I take this opportunity now to hand over to National Treasury to brief us, and then we will take questions afterwards. Good morning and welcome, National Treasury. Over to you.
Good morning, Chair and honourable members. Duncan Peters here. I'm responsible for the Asset and Liability Management Division at the National Treasury. And perhaps just by way of introduction, the asset and liability management division in the Treasury has two responsibilities. The one is oversight of Schedule 2 entities, your large entities with borrowing powers like Eskom and Transnet, and related responsibilities. And then also the Asset and Liability Management Division is responsible for debt management. So the processing of guarantee requests, the issuance of the bonds on behalf of the sovereign, the treasury bills, and so on. All of that sits, Chair, with this division. I'm joined by several colleagues this morning that will introduce themselves as we go along. And thanks to them also for, I see, flighting the presentation and also for assisting with the preparation of the presentation. Before I start, Chair, I think it's helpful perhaps just to point out that all of the information that we are covering today is always articulated in detail in the budget review, in particular chapters 7 and 8. So chapter 7 of the budget review deals with the guarantees and the current status and all the guarantees that are in place. And chapter 8 deals with the state-owned companies. And so if the members would at any point like any more detailed information than what we provide today, they can just download those two chapters of the budget review. And we obviously continuously update that information. The other point, Chair, I wanted to make before I start the presentation is that, as we always say to all the other committees that we engage with, we are always available for engagement. If there's any issue for us to clarify, if there's anything the committee would like more information on, at any point in time, we will make ourselves available because we do think that it is important for us to take Parliament and any other stakeholder, in fact, through some of the detailed work we do. So hopefully, Chair, this won't be the last time that we engage with your committee. Chair, I'm going to do the first slide, and then I'll hand over to Mkulu and other colleagues to go through the rest. But we've structured the presentation to deal with your, as per your opening remarks, the two issues. The one is the issue of government guarantees, how that's changed over the last few years, the new instruction note and so on, and then also state-owned company bailouts. Just to make a few introductory points, it's clear, Chair and Honourable Members, that the state-owned companies are facing several challenges, and in fact, many of these were highlighted already in 2012, and in fact, still persist. There are often multiple objectives that these entities have to fulfill, and those multiple objectives can sometimes be conflicting. And so that makes it quite hard for many of these entities to, for example, execute a developmental mandate, which is important, and also remain financially sustainable. Often they've got inadequate financing policies, they've got a lack of adequate oversight and accountability, and then many of these entities really struggle in terms of the weaknesses in their board and therefore the ability of the board to fulfill their oversight function, as well as a lack of transparency and accountability. And of course, for many of them, over the last decade, there has been a significant decline in their performance. And when we come to the narrative around the bailouts, we will see how this financial, this decline in financial performance have had a direct impact on the fiscal framework as their profits have fallen and their debt levels of these state-owned companies have become increasingly unsustainable. They have also had challenges around their service delivery, their ability to deliver the services that's required by them. We obviously don't have to go into those details, but I think everyone has seen the impact that large critical state-owned companies have had on the economy and on the fiscus, for example, through their inability to export goods and therefore earn the revenue that goes back into the fiscal framework and then gets directed towards social and other expenditure. The various bailouts that we've had, and we'll cover that in great detail later, for Eskom, which has been the largest beneficiary of government bailouts, but also for SAA, SABC, Post Office, and others, have become a financial burden. And these debt levels and the associated bailouts have crowded out important social and other expenditure. And I think when we get to that bailout slide, Chair, and one sees the quantum of those bailouts over the years, then I guess the obvious question becomes, well, what would have been possible with those bailouts had that funding been redirected to social and other expenditure instead of being directed to state-owned companies that are meant to be sustainable on the strength of their own balance sheet and are not meant to qualify for these kinds of bailouts that they've been receiving. So I'll leave it there, Chair, in terms of the introduction. I'll now hand over to Mkulu to take us through the next few slides, focusing on guarantees, the overall context, the changing policy framework, and then we'll get into the details of the bailouts. Thank you. Mkulu?
Thank you very much, Duncan, and good morning, Chair, and the rest of the committee. Just to take us through the background around government guarantees, the Constitution, specifically Section 218 of the Constitution, basically stipulates that national government and provincial governments or municipalities may issue or make guarantee loans if those specify with specific conditions in national legislation. And essentially, then, the national legislation that is referred to here in Section 28, it's made possible then by the Public Finance Management Act, which basically stipulates or provides or grants powers in terms of the granting of guarantees. So Section 66 of the PFMA prescribes the powers. And essentially, those powers or the responsibilities are granted to cabinet members in terms of Section 70 of the PFMA. And essentially, Section 70 also then stipulates that the Minister of Finance has to concur with the issuance of such guarantees, indemnities or securities. Now, in terms from a policy point of view, the issuance of guarantees, which are essentially obligations to meet the obligations of beneficiaries for loans, bonds, repayments, and interest payments under specific circumstances. And these obligations basically are triggered only in the case of the inability of the beneficiary to service such guarantees. So in 1996, public cabinet approved guidelines in terms of the issuance of guarantees. And essentially, the guidelines were that we should limit the issuance of guarantees, essentially allow for public entities to borrow on the strength of their balance sheet, use guarantees in exceptional cases, and levy guarantee fees to equalize the benefit of borrowing cost margins for those two public entities who borrow through guarantees and those who borrow without. Now, over the years, the guarantee portfolio has grown quite significantly. And we've made a point, even in the budget review, as Duncan has said, Chapter 7 of the budget review, to say that the quality of that exposure has decreased as well. So you would see that by March 2021, guarantees that had been issued to public institutions was around 581.6 billion, with the exposure at 384.7. By 31 March, the expectation is that the exposure would be 396.1 billion, while the issued guarantees would be 478.5 billion. Eskom, of course, is the largest exposure at around 85.3 billion. And obviously, the expectation is that this exposure should decline as the debt transfer arrangement takes place over the years. For independent power producers, 208 billion has been issued, and at the moment, or at the end of March, the expectation is that the exposure would be 187.1 billion, with PPPs constituting only around 7.1. South African Reserve Bank, the loan guarantee scheme has been reduced to 20 billion. Of which 10 billion has been used up to date. 12 billion of that 20 billion is for the original scheme, while 8 billion is for the bounce back scheme. Next slide, please. All right. So as I indicated, Chair, there has been a significant deterioration in the quality of our exposure, in that the guarantees that have been issued to entities who have not been able to demonstrate their ability to service this debt. And essentially, this has triggered then a number of recapitalizations so that the entities can service their guaranteed debt. So in order to try and improve this situation, an instruction note was issued in December 2020 outlining minimum criteria that has to be met before guarantee requests could be considered by the Minister of Finance. And essentially, this criteria is largely based on the cabinet-approved guidelines for the issuers of guarantees. And this criteria essentially stipulates that there has to be a demonstrable need for government to accept the risk. And so if it's a project, it has to be in line with the need of the particular state-owned enterprise and the government entity. And the applicant, in this case being the SOC and the specific line minister, would have to demonstrate adequately that the project would generate sufficient cash flows during the term of the underlying transaction. So if it is a 10-year debt that is going to be sourced through this guarantee, then the project has to generate sufficient cash flows over that period in order to service the obligations. The guarantee or the indemnity or the borrowing limit for which approval has been sought should be offered by government. So it should be that in line with the PFMA, the Minister of Finance is able to approve such a request. So it has to be in line with applicable legislation and so forth. The type of project, as I said, it has to be in line with the applicant's mandate, and the department and the SOCs, they have to clearly show that an assessment has been of the underlying project viability has been done, or if it's a DFI of the lending activity. And it has the line ministry has to also show that they have done the assessment and satisfy themselves that the project will yield sufficient cash flows. And if the project is going to yield social benefits without generating enough revenues, then this the project has to be funded through a budget appropriation process, and there's a separate process for that, which then the department would have to go through. Public entities that have not previously adhered to guarantee conditions should not submit applications for new guarantees, and essentially requires that do not meet this minimum criteria will not be considered by the Fiscal Liabilities Committee, which essentially is a committee that recommends to the minister whether guarantees has to be approved or not. And I think just as a caveat, we have to say, in terms of the requests that have been received since the introduction of this criteria, no request has been approved as far, since most of them have not met this criteria. Thank you, Chair. I'll give over to Brenda.
Good morning. Thank you, Mkulu. Chair, I'll be taking you through the slide on historical SOC bailouts. As projected on your screen, we've got a table there that seeks to highlight the allocations that have been made over the past 10 years. And as you can see there, the total allocations over that period comes to roughly 329 billion. This is, of course, subject to the 2023 year, financial year coming to an end, and there may be further revisions in the numbers there as to the actual allocations that were taken up in that year. But overall, the picture indicates that there has been an increase in the number of allocations, not only in quantum, but also in the number of entities that have received bailouts. Some of it is due to external shocks, like the advent of COVID, as we saw in 2020, and the impact that that has had on businesses in general, with one of the entities like AXA being quite affected, being a participant in the aviation industry, and for the first time receiving a bailout in 2021 there of 2.3 billion. And then I just need to make a correction on the SA Express numbers. The 1.58 billion is in fact an allocation against SAA for government guarantees that were legacy government guarantees that still need to be wound up. But yeah, in general, that is the picture that we see. If you reflect on 2014 and the earlier years, the quantum of allocation was not as significant as what we see in the later years. And of course, the largest beneficiary, as was mentioned earlier, has been Eskom, just in terms of the quantum of allocations. I will now hand over to my colleagues to take you through the individual slides to give a little bit more of color to these consolidated allocations that I've just spoken to. Thank you.
Thanks, Brent, and good morning, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members. I'm going to take you through Eskom. As Duncan has alluded to earlier, that Eskom has been the biggest beneficiary of this bailout. In 2008, the bailout started with a 60 billion loan, which was provided to Eskom and dispersed over a three financial year period in the form of 10 billion, 30 and 20 and 20 billion. This was meant to strengthen Eskom's balance sheet as it was undertaking its CAPEX program. However, cabinet approved a provision to support to provide further support to Eskom, and this further support included the conversion of the loan because Eskom at the time was showing signs that it would not actually be able to actually repay the loan, and the financial position was further declining. So cabinet decided to convert the loan into a direct equity, However, this did not have any direct cash flow impact at the time because it was just a transaction to just convert it into equity. The support package included a direct equity of 23 billion that was to be funded through the sale of non-strategic assets. I must indicate that over ND2223, Eskom currently has received, as it has been flighted by Brenda in the slide, in the previous slide, around 181 billion, excluding the conversion of the loan. In 2019 budget speech, the minister announced that government has further set aside 20 billion per year over a 10 year period.
Just 1 second.
We should amount to about 23 billion to 230 billion.
Sorry, hi.
The next slide. Yes, sir.
I'm not sure if there's anybody else who can assist, but your line is not great. You are buffering, and I think most of the things will be lost, particularly in...
Can you hear me clearly now, Chen?
Well, you can proceed, but if in the event that it continues, can somebody else please come in, because that line is not great.
Okay. Thanks. Now, let me try and be quick, Chair. So, of the 230 billion, which was meant to be allocated of 23 billion over 10 years, the situation has come actually declined, and a special appropriation bill was tabled on an urgent basis to allocate further support to Eskom by accelerating the support to earlier years, and that amounted to, instead of 23 billion, it increased to about 49 billion and 56 billion in 2019 and 2021. Further out, an amount of over 31 billion is allocated was provided, and 29. So of the 21.9 billion that has been allocated for 2022-2023, an amount of 11 billion was provided to Eskom by December, and the remaining balance was provided in Jan. Further to that, Chair, in this past budget speech of 2023, the minister has actually announced a proposed support of total debt relief arrangement for Eskom of 250 billion. This has been, it consists of two components. One is a 180 billion, which represents the full debt settlement in three tranches over the medium term, that is over 3 years. The second is a direct takeover of up to 70 billion of Eskom's loan portfolio by 2025-2026. Because of the structure of this debt relief, Eskom will not need to borrow any further, because the entire debt settlement will, and interest will actually be paid by the government support that is provided. Government will finance this arrangement through 66 billion that is left of the 230 billion that was provided initially in 2019. And 180 in additional borrowing over the next 3 years. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff, and morning to the chairperson and the committee members. I'll be taking you through transport sector entity slides, starting with SAA. I'm sure committee members will remember that on the 5th of December 2019, SAA was placed under voluntary business rescue following a sustained period of financial and operational challenges. And the total direct recapitalization amount leading to that point prior to when the airline was placed under business rescue amounts to 22.8 billion. And subsequent to that business rescue period, there were a number of allocations that were made to the airline, first of which was an additional 6.4 billion, which was allocated over the 2020 medium-term expenditure framework period for the repayment of government guaranteed debt. An additional 10.5 billion was also made available in 2021 for the implementation of the business rescue plan following the 2020 MTBPS. More recently, the Minister of Finance announced an additional allocation of 1 billion in the February balance budget speech for SAA to settle outstanding business rescue obligations. Therefore, Chairperson, when the 2023 appropriation bill is assented into law, SAA will have received a total of 50.7 billion in direct funding from government between 2007 and 2022, of which 48.4 billion would have been received in the past 10 years. The next entity which I'm going to be presenting on is AXA. As Brenda alluded to earlier, AXA was one of those frontline entities that were hit the hardest by the COVID-19 pandemic, and it was mainly due to travel restrictions that were placed in the aviation industry. As a result of that, AXA recorded a 92% decline in traffic volumes in the first month of 2020-21 financial year when compared to the previous year. What followed after that was an assessment by the likes of IATA and stakeholders within the industry, which then indicated that traffic volumes were not expected to return to pre-COVID levels in the medium term, which would then lead to shortfalls in available funds for AXA to meet its operational requirements. Therefore, in order to mitigate against the impact of the pandemic, AXA engaged with its shareholders, including government, on possible shareholder support. As a result, and following quite lengthy engagement, government allocated 2.3 billion to AXA in the 2020 MTBPS for the purchase of redeemable preference shares to cover the shortfalls resulting from reduced traffic volumes. Next two entities that I'll be presenting on is Transnet and Sanral. Committee members will remember that last year, Transnet was provided with 2.9 billion to accelerate the repair of locomotives. This was done through a special appropriation bill, and subsequent to that, in the Adjustment Appropriation Act of 2022, Transnet was provided with an additional 2.9 billion for Transnet to restore infrastructure that was severely damaged during the April 22 floods in KZN. Next entity, Sanral. Sanral was allocated 23.7 billion to settle maturing and debt related obligations, including debt which relates to GFIP through a special appropriation bill in 2022. I'll hand over back to Jeffrey to take you through the SADC. Thank you, Jeffrey.
Thank you, Tato. I'll take you through the SABC. In 2019, SABC experienced severe liquidity constraint, which threatened its going concern status due to decline in audience share, resulting in low revenues. As a result, government allocated 3.2 billion to SABC through a contingency reserve. These funds were intended to help SABC to pay bills, acquire new content, and conduct maintenance required in line with its turnaround plan. The SABC was actually required to meet a set of preconditions before any funding was dispersed to it. The next slide. Then moving on to South African Post Office. South African Post Office financial position deteriorated drastically after the cessation of the universal service obligation subsidy in 2013. The unfunded USO mandate, coupled with this outdated business model, resulted in SAPO relying on loan funding for its working capital requirements. As a result, SAPO could not repay these loans, and SAPO was then required a government assistance, which was to the amount of 7.9 billion over a period of from 2014 to 2019 to repay its outstanding debt, as well as to implement its turnaround plan and invest in capital expenditure. Despite SAPO receiving this capitalization and its use of funding being reinstated in 2019, SAPO still could not improve its financial position due to its outdated business model of relying on traditional mail, which is declining globally. SAPO's decline was exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic, resulting in government approving a further recapitalization of about 2.4 billion in 2023 to assist SAPO to implement its new turnaround plan. Thank you.
Okay. Good day, Chair and honourable members. I'll be taking you through Denel and Sasria. So Denel has been experiencing liquidity and solvency challenges that emanated from a number of factors, one of them being weak governance structures, poor program execution, poor working capital management, and a high cost base with declining revenues and poor contracting that resulted in the entity taking on unprofitable projects. So as a result of Denel's ailing financial position, the entity was not able to meet its financial obligations, ranging from its guarantee obligations, supplier and salary payments, as well as tax obligations. As a result, Denel in the financial years of 2019-20, 2020-21, the entity was recapitalized with 1.8 billion and 576 million respectively. These funds were provided in order to be able to support the entity in the implementation of its turnaround plan. So further funding was provided to the entity, or allocated to the entity in 2023 to assist the entity with the completion of its turnaround plan. However, it should be noted with respect to the 3.4 billion that these funds are yet to be dispersed to the entity following the adherence of the conditions that have been attached to this funding. The National Treasury team is currently in the process of reviewing the progress that Denel has made. So that will be the determining factor as to whether these funds will be dispersed to Denel. And then it should be noted that in the financial years of 2021-22 and 2022-23, Denel was provided with funds amounting to 3 billion as well as 204.7 million to enable the entity to be able to meet its guaranteed obligations under its domestic medium-term note program. That is the payment of maturing bonds, as well as the interest that was associated with these bonds. And then we move on to Sasria. That is, following the July unrest in 2021, Sasria received claims which were higher than anticipated, and this significantly led to the deterioration of Sasria's financial position. So as a result, in the 2021-22 financial year, government recapitalized Sasria with 22 billion. This allowed the entity to be able to settle valid claims that arose out of the July unrest, as well as to recover the entity solvency cover ratio in line with the Prudential Authority's regulatory requirements. That's it from me, Chair, and I will hand over to Lefense to take us through the following entities. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, members of the committee, and good morning, everyone in the meeting. I'll only be talking about the Land Bank and the DBSA, which are the development finance institutions. Since National Treasury took over Land Bank in 2008, Land Bank has actually received a total of 13.6 billion. But basically, the bigger chunk basically of this bailout came after the default of the Land Bank in 2020. So in between 2010 and 2013, Land Bank received about 3.5 billion. That after Land Bank has actually made big losses and it was not able to operate. So its liquidity position was actually affected greatly. So the Land Government had actually come in to save the Land Bank. Then in 2020 came the default of the Land Bank after it was downgraded by Moody's. And then the first thing that the government had to do was to find how they can actually support the Land Bank. So they provided Land Bank within the same year with a 3 billion, and then it was followed by a 7 billion, which we're still working on in terms of transferring that amount. Part of that amount will be transferred this year before the end of this current month, and then the rest of the money will actually go to the Land Bank in the coming years. That part of the guarantees Mukuli has covered it. I don't need to talk about it. Then we move to the Development Bank of South Africa. One would remember that between 2009 and 10, DBSA made losses of about 2 billion. And then the minister requested DBSA to actually restructure. And then this DBSA later came in with a plan on how they can actually restructure themselves. And that's when the minister basically gave them the new mandate to even go further into African countries. And then the minister supported DBSA between the 2014 and 2016 with about 7.9 billion rand in order to transfer it, to support its own new strategy, the restructuring, and also to support the weak capital position after their loss, and also to support the new development mandate. Thanks very much, Chair.
All right, thank you very much for that. All right, colleagues, we think field your questions and direct it to the entity you want clarity on, as opposed to one by one, and then the relevant National Treasury official will then respond to questions. Any hands?
Mine's up, Mr. Chairman.
So I just can't see this side. All right, Mazaba, you can proceed. So, Honorable Liz.
Hi, Mazamba, and good day. Right, Mr. Chairman, thank you to National Treasury, and nice to see some old friends there. I hope my grandchildren aren't watching, because they're going to be terribly confused, because a member of the National Treasury team has used my name as his own. So, Mkulu, we share a name as far as my grandchildren are concerned. But be that as it may, Mr. Chairman, some general questions about guarantees. In terms of the Section 218 requirement for a report to be published, Duncan's quite right. It's all there in terms of the national government in the ENE. But my question is, where do we find it for provincial and municipal governments? Does National Treasury have a grip on all the guarantees issued by provincial and municipal governments? And whilst the Section 70 requires that cabinet members get concurrence from the finance minister, what is the who does the finance minister also have to give concurrence for provincial and municipal guarantees? So if National Treasury have all the stats, I don't think they can give them to us now, but if they could give us a report on that. If they don't, then we really are at high risk. Talking about risk, Mr. Chairman, there's a requirement for concurrence of Finance Minister to Cabinet members. How sure are you, National Treasury, that Cabinet members have indeed obtained the required concurrence before issuing the guarantees? Are you aware of every single guarantee that's been issued? Are you comfortable that you've been informed? Because guarantees are not a debit or credit item. They're a contingent liability. So it's not that difficult for them to slip by. They're not part of double entry bookkeeping. So that's just the general thing on guarantees, Mr. Chairman. Then I'm going to carry on. Is that what you want us to do? I've got a few more questions, not too many.
Proceed, field all of them. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just need really more clarity on the SA Express bailout of $1.583 billion. I'm just not understanding what's going on there. There's a link between SA Express and SAA. Is this effectively an additional bailout for SAA? Or just the detail there of what it's about. Now, Mr. Chairman, on the 25th of June 2022, I received a response from the Minister of Public Enterprises to a question about guarantees. And the response was that of the 19.1, I think it is, billion in total, only 1.2 billion was still in place. And of that 1.2 billion, 377 million was in use. But when you look at Table 11, a National Treasury report that the full 19.1 billion is still in place and 300 million is in use. It worries me that there's this discrepancy in numbers, because it kind of leads back to what I asked earlier about, does National Treasury have a handle on all guarantees? So can that be explained? The other question then is, if the 19.1 billion in guarantees is still in place, what surety can National Treasury give us that SAA have not accessed those guarantees since they started operating again in order to meet the losses, the operating losses they're incurring? In terms of the general comments, I think Duncan asked a question about the wisdom of spending 50 billion on SAA as opposed to and other bailouts. The FLC presumably recommended to the ministers of finance at each point in time that these guarantees be issued and bailouts be paid. And so whilst it's certainly the responsibility of the line department, but the Minister of Finance has a responsibility to safeguard money as well. So did the FLC, did the minister always follow recommendations of the FLC is my question. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let's leave it at that.
All right. Thanks, off. Honourable Van Meenen and then Honourable Mente.
Thank you very much, Chair. What concerns me very deeply is essentially how long is a piece of string? I mean, these ongoing bailouts, the ongoing transfers, the ongoing assistance to SOEs that, quite frankly, if you look at some of them, are failing because they are not providing people with services which they need and require, and which SOEs are are in existence for, why is there an insistence to keep bailing out SOEs that are completely failed, that should in fact be declared insolvent? And so why are we throwing good money after bad and continuing with this trail of loss without actually getting any returns on them? Thank you.
Honorable Mente.
Thank you very much, Chair. Chairperson, let me first thank you for giving us this briefing, because it's been not clear on what basis are we doing the business with a national treasury, especially after all the announcements that have been made. Now, Chair, the first question I have is on the matters of ESCOM. But let me first make this statement to National Treasury that we know the services that we are bailing these SOEs for are services that are required by our people. And if these state-owned entities are failing to produce such services and render them for the people, the state has to do it because the people belong to the state, and therefore the state cannot fail its own people. Now, the first question, Chair, is on the basis of the IFMS system that has never been fully developed in order to assist the expenditures and procurement processes of the state. Now, we are facing most of these problems simply because of incapacities and also thuggery and corruption. But without a proper monitoring system from the National Treasury side, even with these bailouts, we are not going to yield any positive results. Now, the first question is, how are we going to monitor the usefulness of these bailouts and guide on how they should be allocated and the expenditures thereof? What's the monitoring tool that National Treasury is going to use to follow up the usefulness of the bailout in order to curb the unnecessary wastage that is occurred before? Then number two, there's a statement that was made, I think, in the earlier slides, that those SOEs who have not complied with the provisions will not be allowed to apply. So they will not be permitted to apply for any bailout. But the problem, like I said earlier on, these are the services that our people require. Mazambane made a statement earlier on that we have these bailouts at the level of municipalities and provincial governments. And simply because we know they are at the cold face of service delivery, and if we do not intervene as National Treasury, there's nothing that our people are going to benefit out of the state. So if you are saying people will not be permitted if ever they do not comply, what are the measures that you put in place in order for you to intervene for the people who require those services when a particular SOE is not going to be given a bailout and be guided accordingly on how to do the business as it was required? So at ESCOM, there was a 2019 bailout with now 66 billion as a baseline, which is now left and is going to be utilized to do whatever business they have applied for. but we do not see the account where the entirety of the transactions which took place on the bailout as it was issued in 2019. Is National Treasury satisfied with how the money was utilized since it was given as a bailout 2019? Whatever was utilized before this 66 billion, are you satisfied with those transactions? If yes, how are they helping us? If no, what are the remedies that you are putting in place in order to mitigate all these shortfalls? Same applies to SAA. You say for 10 years there was a 50.7 billion. There are shortfalls. And if you are not remedying the situation and you continue to give a bailout without identifying what are the problems and how are you dealing with those problems? We are going to, again, next year say there is 60 what billion that was given for the past 11 years to SAA and we are required to give this one. We ought to have an account of from this point to this point, this is how fruitful it was and these were the shortfalls and this is now a new plan and not only provide money, but not have a plan and the remedies in place in order to cure whatever the shortfalls were. At SAPO, your statement is very clear that there is capacity challenges. SAPO requires this bailout and as things stand with all the plans and the turnaround strategies and whatnot, it doesn't look like SAPO is having capacity to deal with its own business strategies. Are there any plans that you as National Treasury working with SAPO? Are you guiding them? Are you intervening? Or you are just going to give them a bailout, leave them with their business, and when they come back with failures, you are again going to say, no, we'll have to deal with it. We'll have to bail you out again. But we were not there in the picture. Is there anything that is happening to assist the capacity of SAPO? But lastly, Chair, in all of this, we have seen how the 1 billion of the floods where KZN and Eastern Cape is concerned had challenges. And those issues of people who could not apply and everything. But there's been a mentality from National Treasury that the capacity which they are aware of that's lacking at all these SOEs and municipalities and provincial government, they never have someone allocated to any funds allocated to any of those areas for bailout. In this instance, can you assure us that at least there is someone allocated to each and every SOE to guide, to compile reports, to assist them in procurement and expenditure frameworks and ensuring that the money is going where it's supposed to go to and then not have situations where we get declarations of people saying the money was intended for this, but tenders that were paid outside and then political parties were beneficiaries of such monies. Thank you, Chair.
Right. Let's get Honorable Bukas and then National Treasury team, you can respond. Honorable Bukas.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I'm still struggling with the video of this new device.
No problem.
Thank you. Thank you to the National Treasury for the presentation. Chair, my first one is on the challenges identified in the presidential review of 2012, and one of it was a lack of adequate oversight and accountability. I want to know from National Treasury, what in their view is the current situation, and are there any improvement? Then secondly, Chair, on the NEL, they received an allocation in 2019, 2020, and 2021. National Treasury received any plan of action on how to address the weaknesses in the NEL, especially how they will strengthen weak governance structures and poor program execution. Then, Chair, on the decline in performance in all the SOEs, but there's a decline in performance, but the operational cost increase, and there's an impact on poor service delivery. So how are they planning to address that? Honorable Mente asked about the monitoring tools. So are there any tool or how do they measure the impact of this bailout in the SOEs? And then lastly, Chair, the public entities, one of the criteria is that the public entities that have not adhered to the guarantee conditions should not submit for new guarantees. Now, Chair, maybe it's a stupid question, but I will ask it. Seems to me that if they can't adhere to the conditions, they are putting under debt relief or business review. Am I right to assume this? Thank you, Chair.
All right. Thanks, Honorable. Omar Zambane has a small Nyana follow-up that she just wants to add, and then National Treasury, you will determine who goes first on your end.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, it is. And Honorable Vierkes is touched on it now. So in terms of the statement made by National Treasury that if the conditions aren't met, no further bailouts or guarantee are issued. In terms of the Eskom, I think it was the 2019 bailout, one of the conditions was the appointment of a restructuring officer. Was that appointment made? Who is that appointment and how successful has that been? Thank you.
All right, National Treasury, over to you.
Okay, good morning again, Chair. So let me deal with some of those questions, and then I'll ask different colleagues to come in on some of the others. And we'll make sure, Chair, that we cover all of the different questions. So starting with Honorable Lees, there was a question about provincial municipal guarantees, as well as whether we are aware of every single guarantee that comes through. I will ask Mkulu to come in on that question. There was a question, Chair, about SAA Express and the 1.5 billion. Solo can add here, but Brenda can add here, but she did mention in her presentation that particular table was actually incorrect. She did highlight the fact that 1.5 billion that is there for SA Express is in fact for SAA. But she can come in on that point again, Chair. In terms of the other questions around the minister, the advice given by the FLC, so the way it works, Chair, is that the FLC, which I happen to chair, and which consists of the various other DDGs or some of the other DDGs in the Treasury, would make a recommendation to the DG and to the minister. I do not have the record of every single decision, but I can imagine that there would have been occasions where not every single recommendation that is made is followed exactly in the way that it was made by the minister or by the DG. And the reason for that, Chair, is that the ultimate accountability for these decisions lie with the Minister of Finance. And so, and of course, supported by the DG. So it's important for us to also just appreciate that distinction there, in the sense that in the same way that on the budget, for example, the National Treasury makes a recommendation to Cabinet, but the ultimate decision lies with Cabinet and subsequently Parliament, there would therefore be occasions where the decision is either not followed to the T, or there is a tweak to the ultimate decision. Honourable Firmin asked about why continue bailout to SOCs that clearly are struggling to meet their obligations. I think the Minister of Finance has spoken about that extensively, especially in the last two budgets. And that is why one of the things that we have done, Chair, is to move to a situation where through, and I'll come back to this, through the implementation of pre-disbursement conditions as well as other mechanisms, we are, in granting bailouts to SOCs, also dealing with the underlying structural issues. Because to the point that Honourable Mente made, unless you deal with the underlying structural issues that have put the SOCs in that position, it's likely that your bailout is not going to make the situation better. So there has been quite a big shift, at least in the last year, where if one looks at the bailouts given to Sanral and Transnet and Denel last October, as well as the bailout given to Eskom in this budget and to other entities, those have come with very strict preconditions, which are the conditions that those entities have to meet before the funds can flow. And they include things like selling, and we do present these conditions in Parliament when we table the budget. They include things like selling non-core assets, strengthening partnerships, dealing with procurement and other challenges, and obviously also very specific conditions around reporting and oversight. Moving now to the questions by Honourable Mente, she asked a question about the monitoring system that we put in place. I'll ask Ravesh to come in on that question. There was a point about access to bailouts if they don't meet any of the conditions. And as was later mentioned by Honourable Beekers, it's actually access to guarantees. So what happens, their access to future bailouts is not necessarily a function of whether they meet the conditions or not. That is something that applies to guarantees and not to bailouts. The utilization of historical ESCOM funding, whether we are satisfied with the utilization on that front, was another question by Honourable Mente, and also of SAA. I think just on ESCOM, Chair, it is clear that the bailouts that we've given ESCOM up until now has not managed to address the entity's underlying liquidity and solvency challenges. And a big reason for that has been that even while we've been giving the bailouts, the entity's debt burden has continued to balloon, and obviously some of the operational challenges have not been resolved, which is why in this budget, we made two quite significant changes. The one is we have instituted a provision that ESCOM is no longer allowed to borrow for the debt relief period, so that we can deal with the debt burden that continues to become a problem. And then as well, we've also instituted the National Treasury with the DPE, our own independent operational assessment. We've appointed an international consortium to conduct an independent operational assessment of ESCOM, so that we can get to the bottom of the operational challenges. And that reflects the fact that the bailouts that have been given in the past clearly has not had the desired liquidity solvency effect or the desired impact on operations. On SAA, Chair, we can clearly, if one looks at where the entity is now,
the entity is in a better space relative to where they were before. But I think Ravesh and his team can just add on our perspectives on the utilization of those SAA historical funding and the same for SAPO. This reminds me, Chair, while I'm on Honorable Mentor's questions, that the other question Honorable Lise asked was also around the SAA access to the guarantee and the discrepancy between the 19 billion that's in the presentation and Minister Gordhan's answer around the utilization of guarantees going forward. Ravesh and team can come in on this, there are no guarantees. The guarantee facility for SAA, as per Minister Gordhan's response, has been reduced in line with their most recent bailouts. So the Ravesh team can come in on that. That's the one question that I forgot to deal with from Honorable Lees earlier. Assistance from Treasury to SOCs. I think, which was the final question by Honorable Mente, I think, Chair, the dilemma that we always face is that on the one hand, we have analysts in the Treasury, and many of them spoke today, that cover the various state-owned companies and who are always there to engage state-owned companies on their guarantee requests, on procurement challenges, and so on. But you also, of course, have a board and a management who are ultimately the accounting authorities for these entities. And so for the National Treasury, there's a very delicate balancing act between A, providing support to these entities, but B, making sure that the accountability still rests with the appointed authorities who have that accountability, the boards and the executive management. So yes, we do provide assistance, and yes, we do quite a lot of monitoring, and Ravesh and team can touch on that. But of course, we have to strike a delicate balance there. And Chair, let me then conclude with Honorable Birka's questions. Ravesh and team can talk about the Denel plan, whether it's sufficient to address the weaknesses, and they can talk about the pre-disbursement conditions that we've instituted there, access to guarantees if they don't meet the conditions, shouldn't business rescue be a natural next step? I think, Chair, there, clearly I would make two points. The one is that, of course, it is up to the shareholder representative, which for many of these entities, with the exception of the Land Bank and the DBSA, is in fact the Department of Public Enterprise to make that decision. But it is clear that if after successive failed bailouts and we are unable to deal with the underlying challenges, government has to consider a different approach, which is why the President, both in SONA and in his remarks in Parliament last week or the week before, made the point about the need for the National Treasury and the Presidency to expedite its work around the review of the consolidation, retention, and so on of various public entities to complement the work that PSEC is doing on the major state-owned companies. And then there was also a question about procurement and procurement challenges specifically at state-owned companies. And I think I would just answer that before I hand over to the rest of the colleagues in two ways, Chair. The one is that whenever these bailouts take place, there are various, which Ravesh will touch on in response to Honorable Mente's question, there are various reporting requirements that are associated with it, which then allows the Treasury to gather various kinds of information in order to strengthen our oversight function. But one of the things we have done last year is through instruction note number 3 of 21-22, we gave the accounting authority back to, the procurement authority back to the accounting officers for all PFMA institutions.
And this was specifically the procurement authority to deviate or to request exemptions. And when those accounting officers do that deviations or exemptions from procurement, they then also have to inform both the relevant treasury, which is ourselves, as well as the auditor general. And that's how we have further strengthened the ability of those accounting officers to take full responsibility for their account, for their procurement, but to make sure that there is proper oversight, both from a treasury perspective, but also from the perspective of the auditor general. I will now ask Chair, the other colleagues to come in. I think Mkulu will start in terms of the provincial municipal guarantees. Are we aware of every single guarantee and so on? And then Ravesh and team will kick us off on some of those SAA and other entity specific issues. And if there's anything we haven't answered, Chair, you will just advise us accordingly and we will come back. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair. And thank you, Duncan. What we have a guarantee register essentially that incorporates all guarantees that have been issued at national level. At a provincial level, the Provincial Borrowing Powers Act essentially governs the guarantees that may be issued by provincial government. And the Provincial Borrowing Powers Act essentially has or prescribes a committee that has to agree to the issuance of either debt, loans, or guarantees by provincial members of executive councils, and by virtue of the Minister of Finance being part of this committee, that would then provide the National Treasury to a certain extent with side of any guarantees that may be issued at those levels. I think that's essentially the answer I would give with regards to that. The other issue I think that has been covered, and I think Duncan has covered that as well, but in terms of our monitoring, I mean, the FLC, its mandate isn't only to provide recommendations with regards to requests that have been issued, but also to monitor on a quarterly basis the movement in terms of the guarantee portfolio, in terms of the quality of that portfolio, and that also takes into account what has happened in terms of the performance or the credit quality of the individual state-owned enterprises that have been issued guarantees. And that essentially becomes part of the report that goes to FLC, and that report also goes to the Minister of Finance. And that essentially gives the National Treasury, I suppose, the opportunity and the role to have a look at the evolution of, you know, the quantum of the exposure and the quality of that exposure on a quarterly basis. And these are reports that we then provide to the Minister of Finance. I think that would be the issues. I will leave maybe the other issues to members of the committee, to other members from National Treasury to cover some of the questions. Thanks.
Okay, thanks Mkulu, and good morning to the Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. Just to go back to the question from Honourable Lees in terms of the government guarantees and what and how sure are we that that the entities or the executive authorities don't use those government guarantees, or how sure are we that they would not use those guarantees. The other mechanism that is in place as well is the fact that while the government guarantee is concurred to by the Minister of Finance, there are also then, in terms of governance arrangements, the government guarantee agreements, which will then need to be entered to into between the executive authority and the Minister of Finance, and also the lenders that then lend against the government guarantees. So while there may be a facility in place and it may not be in use, they are not then allowed to go and then use the concurrence letter to go and raise any government guarantees with any lender, because a supporting government guarantee agreement will also need to be concurred to by the Minister of Finance. So you have the guarantee itself that is concurred to, and then supporting that is the government guarantee agreements, which then has to be concurred to by the Minister of Finance before they enter into any facility or loan facility with any lender as well. So I just wanted to clear that up. In terms of SAA, in terms of the facility itself, what we have included as a condition for the 1 billion that will be dispersed in the course of this financial year once the bill is enacted, is the fact that all government guarantees will have to be cancelled. So, while, Mr. Vesenia has made it known that we have provided 50 billion of support in terms of bailouts, there are a few government guarantee facilities that are in place, but as part of this 1 billion, we are also ensuring that that as part of the disbursement that we have all guarantees that will be cancelled. So before the disbursement is made, we need that commitment. So at least then that clears out all the government guarantees for SAA. And in the interim, SAA is not allowed to draw down against those guarantees, that are there or that are existing. I think just in terms of the monitoring mechanisms that we as the Treasury have in place, and how we do this basically is in relation to some of the monitoring mechanisms or the monthly meetings, quarterly meetings and weekly meetings, which we have, where we basically then take the guarantee conditions, stroke the, the disbursements or the equity conditions. And we then have a compliance, monitoring, mechanisms through these weekly, monthly and quarterly meetings where we then monitor that. We then also report on a quarterly basis to the Standing Committee on Appropriations, like we do, like we did a few, weeks ago in terms of the report, and also where we have any challenges in terms of some of the reporting around compliance and that nature. So I think that basically helps us to monitor, and also, just as a mechanism that we've also included, which I think Dr. Peterson mentioned, is this around the pre-disbursement conditions as well. So while Ms. Moratoli has mentioned that there would be a 3.4 billion that will be dispersed before the end of this financial year, which is in a few weeks' time, we have also ensured that before this disbursement is executed, that they meet certain preconditions. And one of the key conditions that we've included for Denel is progress around the disposal of some of their non-core assets, which they have committed to us back in 2018-19. We just wanted to make sure that the proceeds from that disposal will also augment this equity support, because we don't want to have a situation where we disperse the funds and then in a few months' time we have a challenge where they haven't made significant progress around disposals, and then we have a situation where the entities like Denel, for example, may come back to the fiscus to basically request for further funding. So there's a lot of self-help initiatives that you know, that Danelle has committed to in their turnaround plan, which we have reviewed, which we have which we've analyzed to ensure that the pillars of the turnaround plan are actually enforceable and can actually be executed. So you know, I think that that is key for us, and hence the the provisional support that's been considered for Danelle, and we are as Ms. Maratoli mentioned, are basically monitoring those conditions to ensure that the funds can be dispersed, but only on condition that we have significant progress, especially around their disposal of non-core assets, which they've already received 900 million rand, and there's a further 900 further odd million rand that they do expect. But we want to see significant progress from them before we can consider any further disbursements for that entity. I think in terms of the post office, we are intervening, I think, through the conditions we've had just recently now, with the team, have had meetings with the DG or the acting DG of DCDT, which is the Department of Communications and Digital Technologies, and the Public Finance Unit of Treasury, and, you know, and ourselves at ALM, to kind of just strengthen some of the conditions around their turnaround plan, especially. So there's a lot of work that's going on there in terms of the conditions for the 2.4 billion. So we are, working quite closely with these entities that we have seen or have been problematic before. But we are just ensuring that we don't have a situation where we have further requests for bailouts going forward into the future financial year. So I think that that is quite key for us to ensure that we play a very nurturing role, if I can use those words, to ensure that we hold their hands, to ensure that all the pillars of these turnaround plans are executable and can be met, and we don't have a situation where there are a further requests for bailouts. To the question from Honorable Lees about ESCOM in terms of the Chief Restructuring Officer, I think Honorable Lees, I think that was it was mentioned in one of the budget speeches back in 2019. It wasn't included as a condition. However, if you need to, if required, we can share those conditions for the 2019 support package, which basically ESCOM reports to us on a monthly and quarterly basis, and they have met those conditions. Hence, the disbursements have been affected with no serious challenges there. Then I'm looking at if there's any other questions that I need to respond to. I think that's it from my, I'm just checking from my team if they want to come in on SAA, Tatu, Tsulufelo on Danelle, and Jeff on ESCOM. If you want to come in, please do. But I think we have basically answered those initial questions. Chair, thank you. Over to you.
All right, thank you very much. All right, Honorable Mente, you had something you wanted to add. Let's start with you. And then Honorable Liz.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, there is a question I omitted earlier on, which was also mentioned in the SONA by the the budget speech by the minister on the conditions of the bailouts of ESCOM. And I would like clarity from the team that why would ESCOM be bailed out and be given a condition that if the bailout should not be utilized in the space of generation and maintenance, whereas those are the bigger factors which are contributing to the sustainability of the business of ESCOM. I'd like to understand that. And then if that's the case, what is it that the ESCOM is allowed to do and not to do, and based on what? Then let me add a follow-up, Chair, on the answers. There's a consortium which was mentioned, which will be undertaking a study or a research on the ESCOM. I want to understand, and I think I heard international. One, isn't there a local consortium that can do this? And what should happen with the outcomes of that consortium? Because we have been subjected to studies of many other people, which some of them led to the wrong specifications of Medupi and Kusile and all of those things. Are we going to have the same situation where the study's outcomes will be enforced on ESCOM, and thus ESCOM should only do what the study says and not what is the business model and the mandate of ESCOM? Thank you, Chair.
Right, Honorable Liz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just the replies from National Treasury in terms of the monitoring of government guarantees that are issued by provinces and municipalities leaves me somewhat unsettled. No one has said they are 100% confident. The information does in fact flow back, but yeah, there is a mechanism. Jim, could we please get the last quarterly report to the FLC and to the Minister of Finance that was referred to, so we can have a look at that, please? Then I'm not quite sure about this billion rand, the conditions of this billion rand latest bailout for SAA. As I understand it, the billion rand is part of the funding committed by, foolishly in my opinion, committed to fund the business rescue plan. And so what's left is 3.5 billion, I think it's 3.5 billion, to fund that plan through the receivership. So my question really is that billion rand presumably is going to the receivership. It might go via SAA, but it's got to go to the receivership, am I right? If that is the case, I love the condition that all the guarantees then get withdrawn and so on. But 377 million rand of those guarantees is being used, I think, for international obligations in terms of unflown ticket sales and so on. So SAA is running at a loss. How are they going to replace the 377 million? Then the arithmetic in terms of the bailouts for SAA, if I add the 1.583 billion to the 48.4 billion, I don't quite get to the 50.7 billion that's shown on slide 11. I'm probably not fully on top of this, but just how does that work? Lastly, just a comment. The appointment of the restructuring officer for ESCOM was a big, big thing when the announcement was made. And so I am really surprised that quite clearly no such person was ever appointed, if I'm hearing correctly. Most remarkable. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you very much, colleagues. There's something that Mr. Peters has said earlier on in the round of responses that they gave. Insofar as if you look at ESCOM, I think to say that they have not, they've given the money, but the situation has not changed. I'm paraphrasing. Now, I think it boils down to an issue of principle, National Treasury. And I think this is where you need to come out very clear. seemingly, and this may sound like a refrain or a broken record, but it just highlights the challenge, right? SABC is probably in the same space. The continued throwing of financial solutions to non-financial problems. The terms and conditions are put in place that you get the bailout and you need to do 1, 2, 3, 4. And then it just never happens, right? And then another crisis is engineered, and then it will be like, well, if we don't do it, then the country comes to a standstill, therefore you do it again. So how binding are these terms and conditions that you are putting on the table? What's the consequence management that comes with non-compliance with the terms and conditions? I mean, Eskom accounts for what, 55% of what you've put out there. And it exists as one of the worst case studies of how not to bail out, because it's come to a point where the country is in a state of disaster simply because of the inability to provide security and energy security. So we had all sorts of stories at the SABC. The post office is literally a shadow of its former self. Danel has got 3 disclaimed audit outcomes, and the last 2 audit outcomes are still pending because they're not yet audited. I mean, it's just failure galore at every aspect, yet financial resources have been made available. So quite clearly, it's a matter of poor financial management, inconsistent with the law, poor planning. And as I'm saying, these are financial solutions to non-financial problems. There's an assumption that if you throw money at it, the problem will be fixed. And there's a lot of song and dance about terms and conditions, monitoring will be strict. And yet none of those things translate into any reality. Honorable Lees makes the last point now, and I think it was made earlier on, but the chief restructuring officer at Eskom, as part of the assurances being put in place that they will, you know, financial management and all sorts of things. Construction of Medupi and Gusile, cost escalation year in, year out, continued shifting of timelines for completion. The picture I'm trying to paint is that money has not fixed these problems. And so I think ultimately what the colleagues are really raising boils down to that. Is there meaning and purpose and commitment to the terms and conditions that are there? Or are they just put there so that in one way or the other they legitimize that a bailout has been given, so that it's not a blank check? Because the history of bailouts in this country is not a positive one. I'm subject to correction, but I'm yet to find a bailout that actually translated into the entity turning around. So, yeah, can we get responses to those follow-ups? Honorable Famena, I see your hand is up. Is it a new hand or a historic hand?
Sorry, it's a legacy hand. I'll take it down.
Okay, so, right. Honorable Somyo, just stand by.
Thank you very much, Chair. My apologies. If the question I'm going to ask has been asked in a way I'm going to ask it. I take it that bail out are a special condition, and therefore they are fully prescribed and in the nature of operatization of such, and secondly, on the realization of required outcomes as per such a bailout requirement. From Treasury, is there any alignment, because you are a supplier of such funds, are there any alignments with the fulfillment of such objectives as they were required for such funds? And what is your actual role in the fulfillment of such, looking into the special nature of such a requisite approach in terms of such availability of such such fund? How structured are you in terms of the ensuring the fulfillment of such objectives going forward? Thank you very much, Chair.
Honourable Mentors, new hand.
Yeah, yes, Chair. Sorry, let me apologize. No, Chair, there's another bothering issue which was mentioned, I think, more than three times, about Denel non-core assets that must be disposed of. And I'm wondering, what are the non-core assets? Because when Denel's mandate started, everything else that was attributed to the business model of Denel was something and everything that they require in order for Denel to be a sustainable business. So when National Treasury says they must dispose of non-core assets, how was that assessed? And on what basis did they then decide that these are non-core assets and therefore they are no longer required in the business model of Denel? And if that's the case, can they be repurposed in order for Denel to sustain itself? Thank you, Chair.
Let's get responses.
Okay, thank you, Chair. I'll kick us off and then Ravesh and the other colleagues will come in. So the question, Honourable Mente, about ESCOM conditions around capital expenditure, just a correction there. In terms of the conditions which are in Annex W3 of the budget review, what we say is that ESCOM must prioritize capital maintenance on its existing fleet, transmission infrastructure, and distribution infrastructure, because we believe that these are the key, and of course these conditions were also agreed with ESCOM and agreed with DPE. We believe that these should be the key areas of focus. Because of ESCOM's balance sheet constraints, they have constrained capital maintenance on the existing coal fleet for a few years now, and that needs to be reversed. And also, there's a massive transmission and distribution CapEx backlog that needs to be addressed. So that is the way in which the condition relates to the capital spending. In terms of the consortium and what will happen to the outcomes, and why not a local consortium? What we've strived to do, Chair, is to appoint the best people in the world at this work. The team that we've appointed has extensive experience doing operational assessments of electricity utilities in India, in Turkey, in many other emerging markets in the world that have very similar challenges to the ones that we have. They have direct experience building power plants and designing them across different technologies and so on and so forth. So for us, it was very important to make sure that we get the best people to do the work. What will happen to the outcomes? Of course, it's not necessarily the case that everything that the team recommends will just be blindly implemented. We will look at it with DPE and ESCOM and then decide how those should be reflected in future conditions for ESCOM, as well as which parts of those should be implemented or not. And ESCOM themselves have confirmed that they are very much looking forward to the outcomes of this work, because they welcome an independent assessment of some of their operational challenges. In terms of Denel and the non-core assets, how was it determined and assessed? Very importantly, Chair and Honorable Mente.
I think we must not repeat a mistake we did the last time, colleagues, when this issue of this international consortium was raised and we didn't get its name. Who are these people? Because I think when we made it from something of this, along these lines was mentioned, and we didn't ask who they are. Sorry about that. Can you just give us the name of this consortium?
Chair, and also to establish if the World Bank is involved in that consortium. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Chair and Honorable Mente. On the second question, is the World Bank involved in the consortium? The answer is no. In terms of the names of the firms that are involved, VGBE is leading the consortium. VGBE, Chair, is the International Technical Association of Electricity Generators from around the world. So they advise a lot of the electricity generating companies around the world on technical generation matters. They are leading the consortium. The other members of that consortium, and Ravesh will come in if I'm missing someone, is RWE Technology is the other member. KWS is another member. And then there is a fourth member of the consortium. There's another two. STIAG, which is a company that runs and constructs power plants across different technologies around in different countries, and then Dornier. So STIAG, Dornier, RWE Technology, KWS, and VGBE. Those are the different members, Chair, of the consortium. Moving on to Denel and the non-core assets. Importantly, the non-core assets that were identified were agreed upon between the National Treasury, Denel, and DPE. So this is not the National Treasury saying to Denel, these are your non-core assets and therefore you should get rid of them. This is the entity agreeing and advising us on what those non-core assets are. And they typically, Chair, include two types of things mainly. But if the committee would like more details, Ravesh can come in with the exact names. They include two things. One, certain parts of their property portfolio, mainly in Centurion. And two, shareholdings in other companies that they do business with. So those are the two main categories of non-core assets there. But Ravesh and team can give a bit more detail there. In terms of the last quarterly report on guarantees requested by Honorable Lise, I'm sure we can find that and share that. We'll just check with the team. Tato will come in on the SAA 50 billion arithmetic, as well as the 300 million number that Honorable Least asked about. Chair, you had a question about how binding are the terms and conditions. I think Chair, we had mainly conditions that were required to be met by these entities after the fact. And very few of the conditions spoke to the fundamental reforms that are required in some of these entities. What we have now started moving to is a very different dispensation, which is a dispensation of pre-disbursement conditions, which are very binding because it means that until the entity meets those conditions, the funding cannot flow. In fact, if the entity does not meet the conditions by a particular deadline, the funding comes back into the National Revenue Fund and is declared as underspending, and the entity has to reapply for those funds. So the shift, I think, into pre-disbursement conditions have become very important because those are binding. The funds cannot be released from the National Revenue Fund until the conditions have been met. Secondly, we have also started moving towards conditions that are much more structural in nature in terms of addressing the underlying issues that are being faced by those entities, number one, and number two, that flow from independent operational assessments of those entities, which again is an area where the National Treasury was not very directly involved in the past, but is now becoming directly involved in. And I think we would agree, Chair, that there are very few bailouts which have worked. Perhaps the DBSA's bailout is a rare exception, and there might be a few others to your question. But in general, these bailouts have not worked, and part of it is because they have not been structured correctly with the right kind of emphasis on the structural issues and the right kind of pre-disbursement conditions, but also because for some of these entities, obviously, some very difficult decisions are required about how they restructure their business. And linking that to Honorable Mente's question about the sale of non-core assets, some of these businesses are financially unsustainable because they have a mismatch between their ability to raise revenue and their cost structures. And so that's why some of the revenue measures include getting rid of assets that are not required, but also dealing with their underlying cost base. And then finally, Chair, from my side, there was a question by Honorable Somio about the bailouts and the objectives and the alignment. I think we have tried to resolve that problem by working more closely with DPE to make sure that the objectives that the shareholder department institutes is aligned also with the objectives of the bailout, so that alignment is there. Before I hand over to Tato on SAA, Chair, and any of the other colleagues who want to come in, there was a question about, Chair, I think by yourself, around the bailouts for different entities, and I think you made the point, which is worth emphasizing. There is always a link between the guarantee portfolio of the state and the bailouts, because by granting an entity a guarantee, what you are doing effectively is saying that the state will step in should there be potential financial challenges with that business. And so one of the things that I think we have to do going forward very carefully, and which we've already started doing, Mkulu made this point, which is that the new instruction note has dramatically reduced the amount of guarantees that have been granted and the quality of guarantees going forward. And over time, as the guarantee portfolio becomes a better quality guarantee portfolio, and as the guarantees that are granted become less and less, the future bailouts also become less and less. Because often, and ESCOM's the best example of this, the bailouts are a consequence of the fact that the state have granted these guarantees. Let me hand over to Ravesh and Tato on SAA, Chair. I hope we've covered all the other questions. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Pirisa and Honorable Chair. I think just in terms of the question around the NEL and its non-core assets, I think, I think we just have to bear in mind that the disposal is at a very sensitive stage, so we wouldn't want to disclose exactly which businesses that they are planning to dispose of, or any of the other private sector Participation initiatives that they are busy with, because that will obviously jeopardize the the transactions. And obviously they are hoping to conclude it quite soon. So, Chair, if you'd bear with us, I think it would be best if through the shareholder department and maybe Danel, when they conclude that, then we can thereafter disclose those details. Then, Honourable Chair, I think maybe just to augment as well, I think what's important with the bailouts that are going to happen going forward into the new financial year is that where we used to, provide recapitalizations through equity injections, the mechanism with Eskom is different, where it's going to be a loan that will be provided, and upon the entity meeting conditions, then it's within a month thereafter or sooner, then we will, upon meeting those conditions, then the loan will be converted into an equity. So I think going forward, that would be one of the mechanisms that we would basically be looking at into how do we deal with entities not meeting these conditions, because we have to ensure that conditions are met. And as Dr. Peterson mentioned, is that we have included pre-disbursement conditions or pre-conditions and post-conditions. But I think with the Eskom debt relief package, I think this sets precedent in terms of how then we take bailouts going forward. I just wanted to add that. And I think in terms of SAA, I'll ask Mr. Masenia just to come in and clarify the numbers and also the guarantee. Thanks. Over to you, Mr. Masenia.
Thank you, Ravesh. Quick responses to Honorable Lisa's questions. The first one was around where the money, specifically the 1 billion, is going to the receivership or not. That is correct, as was stated by the Minister of Finance. That funding is going exclusively to the settlement of business rescue obligations and will not be available for utilization by SAA for with working capital requirements and other requirements. In terms of the tally around the 1.583 billion, that is correct. So if you look at the 1.583 billion, and as Brenda sought to articulate as she was going through that that slide, at this point it more represents a fiscal risk more than an allocation, because only one billion out of the 2.583 billion that was requested has been allocated. And as Ravesh has also touched on, that conditions were attached to these allocations. So Treasury will be monitoring compliance of these conditions, and it is at that point where a decision will be made whether to go ahead with this allocation or not. But at this present moment, that has not been allocated, and hence we are not including it in the final tally of funding that has been provided to SAA to date. And the last question was around the 340 million what remaining exposure in relation to SAA and the condition that says this should be actually closed. And your question, Honorable Liz, was given where SAA is in terms of its operations, will they be able to afford this? We have had several engagements with the airline, and our understanding is that there are viable mechanisms which they can put in place in lieu of these guarantees, which, as you rightfully indicated, they relate to unflown ticket liabilities and letters of credit. And this are the portion that you are referring to is exclusively with local banks. And we believe there's alternative mechanisms that can be put in place. And there is a rationale behind that condition and that requirement for it to be closed off. You will be aware that the nature of this condition is such that it fluctuates and you can't necessarily have it in the fiscal framework. So it is a bit risky from a contingent liability risk point of view to have fluctuating exposure, which is open-ended. So it is against that backdrop that we sought to engage with the airline to actually find mechanisms to replace those with other arrangements so that government does not have this risk. And you would have seen, as colleagues were presenting, that the bulk of these bailouts have gone to the settlement of debt that was due and the entities were not in a position to settle them. And that is what we are essentially trying to avoid here with SAA, that should they be in a position where they are unable to settle this debt, we are required to step in, and you find that that funding is not in the fiscal framework. And Duncan spoke about the crowding effect of such situations whereby you'll have to redirect funding from elsewhere. So thank you.
Just a moment, Honorable Mente. There's an intervention you want to make.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. No, Chairperson, in the answer about the Denel non-core assets, there is an element of coercing the committee into not asking the question of what are those assets. As much as Dr. Peter says it was Denel who came up with the proposal, but the second speaker says because of the nature of the transaction and its sensitivity, those details will not be given to us at this stage. That's not in line with what we're doing. We can't be coerced into a transaction we know nothing about, a transaction that we must agree and be part and parcel of it, whereas we have no understanding and no basis of the assessment and on what basis is National Treasury agreeing that the state must dispose of assets. It's wrong, Chair. We need to get the details. We can't be coerced into it's a sensitive transaction and thus the committee will not be privy to details. We must get the details. They are giving us details of where are the bailouts going to, and those details must be known by the people and us. We are not going to be part and parcel of a report that says we reported to SCOPA. They might have done it to the SOE portfolio committee, but they can't do that to us. We can't be part and parcel of that. We need those details. And the second part of it, Chair, the answer of the consortium is four companies. None of them are even having a background of understanding the conditions of South Africans. It's European companies, and I've gone through the research now. How is that going to assist us when we're stuck with FDGs that we cannot fix due to these kind of advisors of people who have no knowledge of what we're doing, and then they come and impose their own standards on South African conditions that they have no understanding of? Thank you, Chair.
All right. We will follow that up. There was a communication glitch on a matter that Honorable Liz raised with me in January, but it's being resolved. It will partly answer the issue you are raising, Honorable Mente, insofar as this new scarecrow now called market sensitivity. So we will deal with it. Can we flag that matter? It's currently with Parliament Legal. I'm sure when we get it, we will then take it forward, because I think the point is valid in that I know my words very carefully so that I communicate what I want to say. These reports which seek to tick the box and say, well, it was reported, but without granular detail as and when it's required or asked is a problem. So can I beg your indulgence, Honorable Mente, that we await that opinion from Parliament Legal and Honorable Lee, sorry about the glitches that happened around the matter that you put before me in late January, early February. On that, it is being resolved, and we will get a position on it soon. All right. Are there any other questions, colleagues, that you have or comments, or are they in completion of the responses from National Treasury? Yes. No. Maybe.
I
see a bong as Lalo, Honorable Mente, Ebel Jelly Tech on Amsange. He covered us.
Uncatelu, Galela, Uncatelu, Kulum.
I, Econi politician, Nicatelu, Kulum. But let me just say, Mr. Chairman, if I may, I'm being rude here. I really want to thank National Treasury for their input. Let me not leave the meeting sounding like I'm being rude. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Sure. No, I think that is fine, colleague. Look, National Treasury, bottom line is that by your own admission and by our own observation, a matter that we have persistently and I think correctly raised is that the national strategic importance of some of these SOEs, the operative word there is some, it does not mean that the taxpayer must fund them at all costs in an environment where there is an assumption that they can do anything anyhow, and the default position is that the taxpayer has got money to bail them out. And a bailout has to be an exception as opposed to being a norm. And it can't be a coping mechanism for SOEs to carry on business as usual when their operations are business unusual. It just can't be entrenched as a business practice. Because the expectation is that these SOEs, above and beyond serving a national interest, they must be able to generate jobs. They must be able to actively, you know, grow the economy and not be a drain on the economy. And that the state must get money from those SOEs to fulfill other competing socioeconomic responsibilities that the state has. So it can't be the other way around, that a struggling economy now has to finance and subsidize and bail out and give guarantees to SOEs. So it's something that National Treasury you need to look at very, very carefully, inclusive of ensuring the business agility and flexibility of these SOEs to compete favorably and competitively with the other players in their respective spaces in the market. I mean, we've made the point so many times that SABC is competing with ENCA, Newsroom Africa, and so on. So the business model has to respond to competitors, right? So it can't take 6 months for SABC to replace a disc reader somewhere when its competitors literally can just go down the road and get it. So the issue is the PFMA in itself has to be an enabler to ensuring business success, commercial success, commercial viability of these SOEs. It's the rigidity in that space is something that National Treasury has to look at and enhance and allow for these entities to make money. And at some point, National Treasury just has got to say no to a bailout as and when it's required, bite the bullet and face the consequences of what comes with that. So So I think we will come back to these issues, colleagues, as and when the entities appear before us, as we've got, you know, further information, and we will further engage with National Treasury. I want to thank National Treasury team in its entirety for the briefing this morning. It answers quite a number of questions, but quite clearly there's still a long road to be traversed in, you know, stabilizing the space and ensuring that it's not abused. So thank you very much, National Treasury. Appreciate your time and briefing this morning. Colleagues, tomorrow we've got our meeting around ESCOM, insofar as a follow-up to the meeting we had last week, and the terms of reference that the trust should reach you this afternoon for your consideration on the ESCOM inquiry and how we take forward the Mr. Derrida matter. And then tomorrow evening, permission has been granted by the presiding officers that we will meet at 6:30. Should be a very brief meeting. I'm sure we'll be done by 8 with the Department of Public Works and Infrastructure as a follow-up to oversights and other committee reports and recommendations. So tomorrow we are at 10 o'clock and then at 6:30 tomorrow evening. In the absence of any other business, colleagues, going once, going twice, going thrice. Right. Thank you very much, colleagues. The meeting stands adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair.